As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. It's Takuya here.
And I'm Gabby.
And we are the hosts of History of Everything, a podcast which you can probably guess by the name is, well, I mean, it's about everything. Do you want to know why people thought potatoes were evil and would give you syphilis? Are you curious about all the stories of the terrible and stupid ways that people have kicked the bucket over the years? Do you want to hear tales about all of the different badasses of history and the lives that they had brought to life? Well, if so, then look no further. History of Everything is just the right podcast for you. It's available on Spotify, Pandora, and anywhere else that you get your podcast from. Join us for some fun and just see how weird and wacky history can be.
It's become almost a cliche when you hear in the news about someone who seemingly snaps and does something truly horrific. That afterwards you'll hear quotes from people who knew the individual saying how nice everyone thought they were, and how shocked everyone is that they could have ever done something so terrible. Take the story of Howard Unruh, for example. Howard's senior yearbook photo shows a clean-cut kid with a big forehead, a long neck, and round wire-framed glasses. His hair is neatly trimmed and combed. He is wearing a button-up shirt with a neatly knotted necktie. And he's sporting a big, goofy grin. He could have been any of a million other nerdy teenage kids from the late 1930s. You'd never guess that his name would one day live on in infamy. The accompanying caption in Howard's yearbook mentions how quiet he was. It also said, "Despite his apparently shy demeanor, Howe, as he's referred to, made a great many friends with his fellow members of the practical arts course." Other than that, we know that Howard was in his school science club. He was an average student. His only known existing report card showed mostly B's and C's. An October 1949 psychiatric report about Howard Unruh described him as having a rather prolonged period of toilet training and slightly delayed developmental skills, meaning it took him till he was about 16 months old before he could walk or talk. It's difficult to say how that would have contributed to him doing something so monstrous later in life, though. It comes across a bit as grasping at straws, with doctors trying to come up with some reason, any reason, Howard Unruh did what he did. Howard was born on January 21, 1921, to working-class parents in East Camden, New Jersey. In a lot of cases of serial killers and mass murderers, there are reports of an abusive childhood. But it doesn't seem like that's the case with Howard. The only real psychological trauma he appears to have endured growing up was when his parents, Sam and Frieda, got divorced. Keep in mind that this would have been something considered especially unusual for the 1920s. Howard's father, Sam, worked on a dredge boat for the American Dredging Company. His work kept him away from his family for long stretches at a time, which, along with the low pay, caused a strain on the marriage. He and Howard's mother, Frieda, separated when Howard was 9 years old. After that, Frieda went to work the assembly line at the Evanson Soap Company in order to support Howard and his younger brother, James. Throughout Howard's youth, he was shy and withdrawn. He didn't have many friends, that is, if he had any at all. He collected stamps and built model trains. He was also a devoted churchgoer who regularly attended services at St. Paul's Evangelical Lutheran Church. After graduating high school in 1939, Howard Unruh worked a series of blue-collar jobs, including working as a printer's helper and a stamping press operator. In 1942, while he was employed as a sheet metal worker at the Philadelphia Naval Shipyard, he enlisted in the Army. This was 1 year after the United States entered World War II. Camden, New Jersey, where Howard Unruh called home, sits on the eastern side of the Delaware River, directly across from Philadelphia. Camden was one of the country's oldest colonial settlements. Its origins date all the way back to 1626 when the Dutch West India Company established Fort Nassau along the confluence of the Big Timber Creek and the Delaware River. Throughout the 17th century, the fur trade became big business throughout the area. with the river becoming a key location to transport goods. For more than 150 years, Camden served as a major economic and transportation hub throughout the Philadelphia area. In 1848, the city was officially incorporated. Following the Civil War, waves of immigrants rushed to the city looking for a fresh start. Although Camden was once prosperous, becoming both a major shipping port as well as the fifth largest city in the state. By the end of the 1940s, the city had begun to show signs of urban decay. And yet, despite the crime rate creeping up over the years, the city of Camden was still considered relatively safe. A place full of close-knit ethnic communities, where everyone knew everyone. This was the backdrop when on a bright September morning in 1949, Howard Unruh woke up, got dressed in his best suit, and ate breakfast. Then he went into his bedroom and pocketed a 6-inch knife, a tear gas pen with 6 shells, and his Luger automatic. Then Howard Unruh stepped out into the street and began murdering people. I'm Nate Hale, coming to you from my top-secret podcasting studio inside the Hollow Moon, and this is The Conspirators. In the wake of Columbine, Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook, and so many other tragic mass shootings, it's easy to think of such horrific acts as a thoroughly modern phenomena. But in fact, there have been mass shootings dating back centuries. When researching the story of Howard Unruh, you'll sometimes falsely see him described as the first mass shooter in American history. In truth, though, there were several others who preceded him. Just 10 months prior to the incident, which is now known as Howard Unruh's Walk of Death, on November 6, 1948, 38-year-old Melvin Collins got into an argument with a neighborhood numbers runner on the sidewalk in front of his Chester, Pennsylvania boarding house. When their argument escalated, Collins pulled out a gun and shot the man dead right there in the street. Immediately after, Collins ran inside and locked himself inside his second-floor room. He then picked up his .22 caliber rifle and began shooting people out the window. Within a few minutes, 8 people were dead, including the first police officer to arrive on the scene. After a long standoff with police, Collins took his own life. Unfortunately, this incident remains largely underreported and mostly forgotten to history, mainly because most of the victims were African American. One of the very earliest reported mass shootings in America occurred on April 9, 1891. That was when a man named James Foster stepped inside the St. Mary's Parochial School in New York and opened fire. The students he shot all survived. Just a few weeks before that, on March 28, 1891, a man armed with a double-barreled shotgun opened fire into a crowd of students and faculty attending a school exhibition in Parson Hall Schoolhouse in Liberty, Mississippi. Over 14 people, most of them children, were injured, with several being seriously wounded. One of the most truly horrible aspects of mass shootings is how desensitized people have become to them. It seems that in recent years they occur with such frequency that we as a society barely have time to process the latest such incident and grieve, before the next one occurs and our collective memories fade of the previous one. I name just a few such incidents above, but this same scenario has played out over and over again so many times it's almost understandable why these events can all blur together and be so quickly forgotten. It can be painful to re-examine such incidents, but we should never try to forget the past, and we should try to learn as many lessons as we can from it. In the case of Howard Unruh, whereas he wasn't the first mass shooter in America, not by a long shot, he certainly fits the bill of what we tend to think of as the quintessential modern mass shooter, a mentally disturbed loner with easy access to firearms and a grudge against humanity. By most accounts, Howard Unruh was an exemplary soldier. He served with the 342nd Armored Field Artillery Battalion, which was part of General George Patton's Third Army. This group of soldiers saw heavy fighting throughout France, Germany, and Italy, and in particular Belgium during the Battle of the Bulge. Although Unruh never rose above the rank of Private First Class, those who served with him would later describe him as an ideal soldier, calm, collected, and good with a rifle. One thing that set Howard apart from his fellow soldiers, though, was that throughout his military career, he remained the ultimate straight arrow. He didn't smoke or drink, and he showed no interest in female companionship during his time in the service. There were plenty of opportunities for male soldiers to fraternize with the local women throughout Italy and France, but Howard showed zero interest in any of that. Instead, Howard preferred to spend his free time reading his Bible or writing in his diary. One time, one of Howard's fellow soldiers managed to sneak a peek at his diary, and he was appalled by what he read. It turned out that Howard really, really liked killing Germans. So much so that he would carefully note the date, time, and place of each man he killed. He would also include as many vivid details as he could recall of each bloody moment. Howard Unruh was honorably discharged from the Army in 1945. From there, he settled into a three-room apartment in the working-class neighborhood of Kramer Hill in East Camden that he shared with his mother. One other thing that Howard Unruh shared in common with a lot of other mass murderers is that he suffered a rather aimless existence, one that seemed both dreary and hopeless. Many psychologists have pointed to a desire for such an individual to feel important, and for them to perform an act so shocking that it makes them feel like they made their mark on history. Howard Unruh enrolled in Temple University's pharmacology school, but dropped out after 3 months. He dated a girl from his Bible study group for 2 years before abruptly breaking things off, telling her that he was, quote, schizo, and had no intention of marrying her. During their entire relationship, Howard never even held her hand or attempted to kiss her. Following the war, Howard missed his army days. He kept a collection of military memorabilia he had smuggled home from the war. He spent much of his time holed up in his bedroom where he hung a pair of crossed bayonets on the wall, alongside framed photographs of armored vehicles and other scenes from the war. Howard occupied his time collecting stamps, reading his Bible, and playing with his model trains. He also set up a homemade shooting range in the cellar of the apartment building where he lived with his mother. He bought himself a 9mm Luger pistol from a pawn shop, and he would often spend hours down in the dank cellar shooting at targets. Most of Howard's neighbors thought he was odd but harmless. He was quiet and mild-mannered, always polite, and painfully shy. Some of the neighbors secretly called him a mama's boy behind his back, and a few came to suspect other things about Howard as well. It turns out that Howard Unruh was a closeted homosexual. This was at a time when many anti-sodomy laws were still on the books, and being gay could land a person in jail. Howard would make frequent trips to Philadelphia where he'd hang out in locations where men could meet other men both discreetly and anonymously. For about a year, from September 28, 1948 to August 28, 1949, Howard kept a room in a Philadelphia lodging house where he could have anonymous liaisons with other men. Ann Mitchell, an African-American maid who cleaned Howard's room, took an immediate dislike to him, after she kept finding racist words he had scribbled in the dust on the writing desk. Living this secret life only contributed further to Howard Unruh's growing hostility toward the world. He remained unemployed and had no real life goals or aspirations. In time, he began to keep another diary, but instead of writing about dead Nazis or even his illicit sex life, Howard Unruh began to write lists of all the people he felt had wronged him. He wrote in his diary that Maurice Cohen, the druggist who lived next door, had shortchanged him 5 times, while Cohen's wife Rose complained about Unruh's habit of listening to classical music on his radio too loudly late at night. At the same time, the Cohens had a son who they allowed to practice his trumpet as loudly as he pleased. The Cohens had also given Howard and his mother permission to use their backyard gate as a shortcut, but they soon began complaining that Howard kept leaving the gate open, allowing stray dogs to get into their garbage. Things grew so tense with the situation that Howard's mother hired a handyman to install their own gate for them to use. There was a couple who lived below Howard's apartment who threw trash into his backyard. A shoemaker named John Pilcherick buried even more trash close to Howard's property. Thomas Zagrino, the local tailor, supposedly began spreading rumors that Howard was secretly gay. A barber named Clark Hoover spread some dirt over a vacant yard that caused heavy rainfall to flood Howard's cellar. A local restaurant owner named Dominic Latella allegedly referred to Howard as a gun-toting gangster. There was also a teenager named Carl Sorg, who tapped into Howard's electricity to light up the Christmas trees he sold on the street. Over time, Howard's list grew longer and longer with the names of people he had grievances with. He also began making cryptic notations alongside many of the names, things like RET period, W period, T period, S period, which was shorthand for retaliate when time suitable. Howard reached his breaking point on Monday night, September 5th, 1949. That was after he drove home from Philadelphia, where he had spent time in a Market Street movie house that was a known gay pickup spot. However, Howard had gotten held up in traffic, and by the time he got to the theater, his intended date had grown tired of waiting and left. Howard then sat through three showings of the double feature, completely blind with rage to the movie flickering on the screen before him. He sat there in the darkened theater, feeling the anger and rejection boiling inside his veins like a volcano ready to erupt. This all came to a head when he arrived home at 3 a.m. That was when he discovered his newly installed gate had been badly damaged by vandals. Howard instantly jumped to the false conclusion that the culprits must have been the Coens, who had destroyed it out of spite. In truth, the gate had been vandalized by some local kids, but by then it was too late. Howard had already made up his mind that the time to retaliate was now.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the golden age of piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories? Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
Howard awoke promptly at 8 in the morning on Tuesday, September 6, 1949. He cleaned himself up, shaved, and put on his best suit, white shirt, and a striped tie. His mother, Frieda, had made him a breakfast of fried eggs and cereal. After he ate, Howard went down into the cellar where he found a length of heavy lead pipe. He had once intended on using the pipe on Carl Sorg if he ever saw the young man setting foot on his property again. But instead, Howard carried the pipe back upstairs to his apartment where his mother waited. Howard called his mother into the living room. When she came in to see what he wanted, Howard raised the pipe menacingly. "What do you want to do that for, Howard?" she asked him, suddenly terrified. Frieda backed her way towards the door, then turned and ran through it out into the hall. From there, she ran out of the house to a neighbor's. Howard never even got a chance to take a swing at her, as he planned. He put down the lead pipe. Then he went into his bedroom and got his 9mm Luger. He put it in his pocket along with some extra ammunition, a 6-inch knife, and a tear gas pen with 6 shells. Then Howard Unruh went out into the street to complete his list. It was 9:30 a.m. He cut through his backyard to the 3200 block of River Road. Along the way, he took an errant shot at a bread delivery man sitting inside his truck, but he missed. He then went into John Pilcherick's shoe repair shop. The 27-year-old owner was kneeling by his bench, nailing a sole onto a shoe when Howard walked in. Without uttering a single word, Howard raised the pistol and shot the cobbler twice, once in the stomach and once in the head. Pilcherick crumpled to the floor. Another young boy was in the store at the time. He ducked and hid behind the counter, expecting Howard to keep firing. But instead, Howard just turned and left the shop. Next, Howard stepped out onto the street, then turned and entered Clark Hoover's barbershop next door. At the time, Hoover was busy cutting the hair of a 6-year-old boy named Oris Smith, who was sitting on top of a carousel-style horse as his mother Catherine watched over them. Howard said, "I've got something for you, Clarky," just before he raised his Luger and shot both the barber and the little boy. Catherine Orris's blood-curdling shrieks could be heard a block away, but Howard just ignored her. He turned and walked out the front door again. Back out in River Road, Howard took a pot shot at a boy staring at him from a window but missed. He then took another errant shot at a tavern across the street owned by Frank Engel. That shot missed as well, but it alerted Engel to what Howard was doing. Engel looked out the window and saw Howard walking ramrod straight down the street with his gun in his hand. Engel dashed upstairs and grabbed his own .38 caliber pistol. Meanwhile, Unruh reloaded his Luger and headed towards the drugstore, owned by his nemesis, 40-year-old Maurice Cohen. As he approached the drugstore, Cohen stepped out and said, "What's going on here?" That's when he spotted Howard Unruh approaching him with a gun. Cohen turned and fled back inside. Immediately after, a 45-year-old insurance agent named James Hutton stepped out the door. He came face to face with Howard, who said, "Excuse me, sir." Only Hutton didn't move out of the way fast enough, so Howard shot him in the chest and head. Howard stepped over the man's body and entered the drugstore. He saw Maurice Cohen running up the stairs to his apartment. He shouted for his wife and 12-year-old son to hide. Rose Cohen shoved her son into a clothes closet before climbing into a different closet and pulling the door shut. Maurice Cohen climbed out a window onto the porch roof, while his 63-year-old mother Minnie rushed to the telephone to call for help. Howard spotted Cohen outside the window. He shot the man in the back. The druggist tumbled off the roof and landed with a thud on the pavement below. Howard heard the sound of a woman whimpering from inside a closet. He fired 3 times through the door. Then he flung open the door and shot Rose Cohen in the face. He then heard the sound of someone shouting frantically for help into the telephone. He stepped into the other room and shot Minnie Cohen multiple times before going downstairs and back onto the street. Unruh reloaded once again. Now he turned towards Thomas Segrino's tailor shop. Along the way, he killed 4 more motorists who happened to cross his path. One of these was 24-year-old Alvin Day, a television repairman and World War II vet, who slowed down at the corner when he spotted Hutton's body. Unruh strolled up to the driver's side window and shot Day in the head through the window. Accounts vary as to exactly what Howard Unruh did next, but it's known that at some point he fired through the windshield of a car stopped at a red light, instantly killing the driver, 37-year-old Helen Wilson, and her 68-year-old mother, Emma Matlack. He also wounded Helen's 9-year-old son, John, with a bullet to the neck. The boy would live for another 18 hours before finally expiring in the hospital. Howard Unruh entered the tailor shop looking for Thomas Segrino, but the first person he saw was Segrino's 28-year-old wife, Helga. She immediately dropped to her knees and begged for her life. Unruh shot her twice at close range. Next door lived a 2-year-old boy named Thomas Hamilton. He was playing next to the window when Unruh mistook the boy's shadow for one of the people he believed to be dumping trash in his yard. He fired a shot through the window, killing the little boy instantly. At this point, Howard decided to branch out even further from his original list of intended victims. He decided to kill Earl Horner, the manager of the neighborhood grocery. However, Horner had locked himself inside his store when he heard all the gunfire. Unruh tried to force his way inside the shop but wasn't able to get in, so instead he fired a few shots through the wooden door as Horner and a few customers hid behind the counter. Unruh then darted into an alleyway. He next broke into a dilapidated house owned by Madeline Harry, a woman in her late 30s. He climbed the front steps, then opened the unlocked front door and strode into the kitchen. There, Harry sat alongside her teenage sons Armand and Leroy. Unruh fired 3 times at her. 2 of the shots missed, but the 3rd struck her in the left arm. 16-year-old Armand rushed at Unruh, but Howard managed to drop him to his knees by smashing him with the butt of his Luger. He then fired 2 shots into the young man's arms. He then raised the gun and aimed squarely at the middle of the boy's chest and pulled the trigger, but the gun was empty. Howard fished around in his pockets for more ammunition, but he was all out. He turned to leave, but then at that moment he felt a stinging blow to his buttocks. He realized he had just been shot. The bartender, Frank Engel, who had finally managed to retrieve his own pistol, had followed Howard and shot at him through a 2nd-floor window. By that point, a swarm of police cars with sirens blaring were converging on River Road. The time was 9:43 a.m. Howard Unruh had only begun his walk of death 13 minutes earlier. In that brief time, he had managed to murder 12 people in cold blood and severely wounded 4 others. After 9-year-old John Wilson died in the hospital, Howard's final body count would rise to 13 people. It's said that Howard Unruh caused such an indelible mark on the neighborhood that the local mailman dropped his bag on the sidewalk and abruptly quit his job and never returned. As the sirens drew near, Howard retreated to his own apartment where he barricaded himself inside. More than 50 officers surrounded Unruh's building. Officers began blasting wildly at the apartment building with machine guns, shotguns, and pistols. Many people in the crowd quickly realized the cops didn't seem to care that as many as 1,000 civilians stood in the line of fire. There was no protocol back then for police to deal with a mass shooting. Such things were practically unheard of in those days. In fact, things were so chaotic that after everything was over and the gun smoke was settled, one of the detectives on the case, Ron Conley, took Unruh's Luger home and kept it as a souvenir. It was only recovered in the 1990s and returned to the Camden County Prosecutor's Office. As news broke of the gunfight going on in East Camden, an assistant city editor at the Camden Evening Courier named Philip Buxton got word that the gunman was a war vet named Howard Unruh, and that he was currently barricaded inside his apartment. He took a chance and looked up Unruh's phone number in the local telephone directory. He dialed the number, and much to his surprise, Howard answered the phone. "Hello?" Howard said. Buxton asked if this was Howard, to which Howard said that was his name, politely adding, "What's the last name of the party you want?" Buxton was taken aback. He said, "Unruh," even as he heard sporadic gunfire going on in the background. Howard sounded completely unfazed. He asked the man who he was and what he wanted. Buxton told him he was a friend and he wanted to know what they were doing to him. Howard replied, "Well, they haven't done anything to me yet, but I'm doing plenty to them." Buxton asked him how many people Howard had killed. Howard said he didn't know yet. He hadn't counted them yet, but it looked like a pretty good score. Buxton then asked Howard why he was killing people, to which Howard replied he didn't know yet. He added that he was too busy and that he'd talk to him later. He said some friends were coming to get him. After that, Howard hung up. It was the strangest interview of Buxton's career. While most criminologists agree that Howard Unruh fits the profile of the quintessential mass shooter in many respects, one key way Howard Unruh differed from many like him is that he did not turn suicidal in the end. In most cases of mass shooters, the murderer will often try to turn the gun on himself rather than allow himself to be captured. Police fired a tear gas grenade through Howard's window. Moments later, Howard came stumbling to the window, gasping for air, shouting to the police that he was giving himself up. Soon after, Howard Unruh emerged through the back door with his hands raised high. He was immediately handcuffed and loaded into a squad car. The crowd of people that had gathered on the street shouted that they should lynch him. One of the police officers angrily snapped at him, "What are you, a psycho?" To which Howard replied, "I'm not psycho. I've got a good mind." For the next few hours, Howard Unruh was interrogated inside a Camden detective's office. During the interrogation, District Attorney Mitchell Cohen, no relation to the druggist on Howard's list, by the way, noticed a pool of blood underneath Unruh's chair. It was only then that they realized that Unruh had been shot. He was rushed to Cooper Hospital for treatment, but doctors were unable to remove the bullet. Less than 24 hours after his arrest, Howard Unruh was transferred to the Vroom Building for the Criminally Insane at Trenton Psychiatric Hospital. This is where Howard Unruh would remain for the next 60 years. He would never stand trial for the mass murder he committed. Over the next several weeks, a team of psychiatrists examined Howard, trying to gain an understanding of what he had done. Many of their findings would not be released to the public until 2012 when they were reported in the Philadelphia Inquirer. During his many interviews, Howard described everything he had done and why. He told the doctors about the list of people he felt had wronged him in some way. He claimed that he felt bad for the children he had shot, although the doctor's notes state that he showed little real remorse. Howard Unruh even told his doctors that he deserved the electric chair for what he had done, but that never happened. It's impossible to know just how much of what Howard Unruh said that we should believe. Much of what he confessed to was done after being administered truth serum, which, contrary to its nickname, remains highly debatable at just how truthful it makes the recipient. Among the many things Howard admitted to under the influence of the drug was that he was molested by his mother. His brother James reported, though, that Howard made unwanted advances toward him while they were sleeping together on more than one occasion, all of which James resisted. On October 20, 1949, a Camden County judge signed an order of commitment based on psychiatric reports, which described Howard Unruh as a paranoid schizophrenic. He was declared mentally unfit to stand trial, although the murder indictment would remain in place were he ever cured. Noted professor of forensic psychology Catherine Ramslin believes that Howard Unruh's original diagnosis was wrong, and were he to be examined today, he would have been found legally sane. Ramslin doesn't think Howard exhibited any of the symptoms of classical schizophrenia, but because he was such a unique case, the doctors didn't know how else to classify him. Howard's father, Sam, was ordered to pay $15 a month for his son's upkeep in Trenton. For the next six decades, Howard Unruh basically vanished from the public eye. In 1964, Howard wrote a petition asking for the indictment to be dismissed on the grounds that he was insane at the time of the shooting, but he soon withdrew it when it became apparent that this would only be useful as a defense in a trial that he didn't want. His mother, Frieda, continued to visit him until her death in 1985. After that, Howard withdrew into himself and didn't talk much. It's known that he once took an art class, and in the 1970s, he admitted to having an unrequited crush on a much younger inmate. Other than that, it's known that he kept up his stamp collection and was known to mop the floors while muttering to himself. In 1993, Unruh was transferred to a less restrictive unit for geriatric patients. This is where he would live out his days. He died on October 19, 2009 at age 88. Early on after his mass murder, Howard Unruh remained a household name. A New York Times reporter named Meyer Burger won the 1950 Pulitzer Prize for his in-depth article detailing Howard Unruh's walk of death. He sent the $1,000 prize money to Frieda. Even today, the article is considered a staple of journalism. But for the most part, Howard Unruh's crime would fade from the public's mind, mostly because it was considered such an aberration. Although there were other mass shootings that followed over the following years, these remained few and far between, unlike today in which it seems like these events are occurring more and more frequently. Today's collective amnesia of these events is based mostly on their frequency, whereas in Howard Unruh's day, the public simply wanted to forget and move on. They would only be able to do so for a few more years, though. In 1956, William Bowers shot and killed seven people, including himself. Then in 1960, a principal at William Reed Elementary named Leonard Redden opened fire into a crowd of 30 students. Then in 1966, Army sniper Charles Whitman climbed a tower at the University of Texas at Austin, where he shot and killed 16 people with a rifle. But that's a story for another day. The Conspirators is written and produced by me, Nate Hale, an entirely fictional identity. Thanks so much for listening. I have some new Patreon supporters to thank. Thank you to Jessica, Donna, Christopher, and Paul for signing up and helping support the show. You're all incredible. Just a reminder, the patrons of the show get access to all sorts of nifty bonuses, including stickers, magnets, t-shirts, and our ever-growing library of bonus mini-episodes. If you're interested in becoming a patron to the show, I'll put a link in the show notes. Elsewhere, I want to remind you that I've begun making short-form videos of many of the same sorts of topics you can find here. Currently, I've been posting videos over on YouTube, TikTok, and Instagram. If you're interested in checking those out, I'll put a link in the show notes as well. Another great way you can help support the show is to subscribe, rate, and give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast. Currently, you can find us on Apple, Spotify, and pretty much everywhere else across the podcasting multiverse. We also have a website, theconspiratorspodcast.com, where you can listen to our back catalog of shows. Feel free to follow us along on our Facebook page or Twitter as well. You can even send us an old-fashioned email at theconspiratorspodcast@gmail.com and let us know how we're doing. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll join us again next time. Before we go, if you're interested in even more stories of some truly despicable individuals like Howard Unruh, then I'd like to direct you to another podcast you may enjoy. Rotten to the Core is a podcast all about some of the worst people in history. Here's the host to tell you more about it.
Magic mirror on the wall, who are the most rotten ones of all? Hello, my darlings, and welcome to Rotten to the Core. Here, we will scry into the past and discover some rotten apples throughout our history. Have no fear, my pretties, for we shall learn a lesson, not only about their horrendous deeds, but also about our own power. Let's step out of the shadow of the past and help pull it towards the light. I am your host, Josh Waters, and I'll be the queen guiding you on our journey. Now, come along, dears. We have lessons to learn. History is waiting.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.